welcome to a very special edition of the Fastest 40 Minutes in Podcasting. That is right, the Unholy Alliance has been brought together, at least partially. We are without a couple members, but we will bring everybody together for the K-State Preview Podcast during our summer of football previews. So welcome to, well, first of all, I am Bill. We have Seth, as always, or as usual.
As occasionally.
And welcome Ty from, or TB from Bring On The Cats. Say hi to everybody.
Howdy, Mizzou fans.
Well, as any Rock'em reader probably has figured out by now, the two sites, we do like each other, not quite to the Al Green level there, but as justification for using that song, the other option was Barry White, which made Al Green seem downright, suitable.
We're going to need a couple more seasons before we get to Barry White.
Yeah. All right, so the two sides have gotten along pretty good. I figure we could talk a little bit about how that has come to be, like how Mizzou fans and K-State fans, what they found to bond. But first, I thought since, we are getting on to football season, it's Football Preview Magazine time, K-State has made some news in the offseason just for the old, new hire they made. And I thought I could ask Ty a little bit about just expectations for the fall regarding the return of Bill Snyder to the K-State sidelines.
The expectations on my part anyway for this year are extremely low, even lower if possible than what I came to expect from Ron Prince. And sorry, Seth, for bringing that name up. But
seriously, you're 2 minutes in, you're going to get me fired up?
You will be happy to know, I think, that with what's happened recently regarding Ron Prince and our athletic department, I think every K-State fan now despises Ron Prince to the level that you did after he left you soaking in the rain in Columbia.
And cold.
In the cold and rain, yeah. I mean, it'd be one thing if it was 80 degrees and raining, but yeah, it was really not a pleasant day that day. We really despise Ron Prince now because of his In Pursuit of Perfection LLC and his $3.2 million buyout, and we're not talking Nick Saban here. We're not even talking Nick Saban's pool cleaner here. We're talking Ron Prince, and we might owe him $3.2 million. It blows my mind.
How? I mean, were there pictures involved here? How exactly did – I mean, I understand that the last athletic director, I mean, this was his man. He took a chance on him. He hired him. He convinced all K-State fans initially that this guy was scary smart and just an unbelievable – he turned out to be the football Quinn Snyder, sorry. But sorry. But – how did it come about that this guy not only gave him an extension after he had a pretty poor second season, but then arranged this, this such a weird deal for all this money behind the scenes 5 years after his firing? I mean, I don't know. Like, there had to be blackmail in there somewhere, I think.
The whole thing boggles my mind, and it really boggles the mind of every K-State fan. Bob Krause clearly was not ever a real athletic director. He's been the vice president of institutional advancement for, the whole time that John Wiefald's been the president of K-State. He was basically an inside convenience promotion to athletic director. And clearly that blew up in our face. When the extension was announced, when the official extension was announced, of course they said this is for recruiting purposes. We want recruits to know that this coach is secure, which he already was still signed for another 3 years, so I'm not really sure why that was necessary, but that was how it was sold to us. Why this secret compensation agreement, I have no idea. I'm afraid, I'm just speculating here, but I'm really afraid that there may be something behind the scenes that could be pretty ugly if it comes out, and it probably will come out because we have litigation going right now involving this. So at some point, probably going to bring some things to light that aren't particularly flattering to a lot of members of our fine university.
Yeah, as I said before the podcast started, as I told you, welcome to Missouri 2003. there, it is just funny how things like things in an athletic department kind of pile up. I mean, I guess technically it's only football. It's not an athletic department as a whole by any means. You have a basketball coach who looks like a mafia member, but that's neither here nor there. He is fun to watch on the sideline.
Yes, Frank does look very, very Scarface-esque, and we love him for that and many other reasons.
Yeah, I think he's one of those very clearly that, I mean, if he succeeds at K-State, everybody, opposing fans will very much enjoy disliking him as much as K-State fans enjoy liking him. Considering that's the description I used to was it Joakim Noah, to describe Joakim Noah the other day to a friend. So I will say I like Frank Martin more than Joakim Noah.
I really can't stand Noah.
Because you're not a fan, see? Exactly. If you were
right.
A Bulls fan. Anyway. All right, so we've got Bill Snyder back in place. As we were discussing before the podcast as well, it's always been kind of my theory that, you know, Gary Pinkel getting there, really not even Mark Mangino yet. He was just getting established when the kind of the slide started after the 2003 season. It's always kind of my theory that Pinkel getting recruits like Chase Kaufman and Tony Temple and some of those Kansas City guys and seeming to do pretty well in the Kansas City area hurt Bill Snyder quite a bit, because he was very much used to beating out Larry Smith back in the day for a lot of kids there in the mid-90s that, I mean, if they had gone to Missouri instead of K-State, K-State would have still been good, but maybe not like 11-12 wins good. But they,
right.
So, I mean, recruiting can make a difference there. Now, granted, Gary Pinkel never, ever beat Bill Snyder on the field. And it really wouldn't surprise me if that's kind of where we stand after this year, too. I do expect a young Missouri team, even if they're pretty good, which I hope they are going to slip up on the road to somebody like that. And it might as well be Bill Snyder again. Damn him. But what are your expectations? Like, long term, I mean, do you think this is a 3-year thing, a 5-year thing, 25, you know, Joe Paterno kind of thing, or what are you expecting long term?
That's really a good question right now. Snyder, from all accounts, from seeing him around Manhattan, seems to be really energized to be back, and I think we all know how energized he was just normally in his prior stint. You know, between staying at the office until 3 a.m., catching 3 hours of sleep, and then being on his way back. I actually have a personal story about that. I was at the Big 12 championship game in 2003, and I had a final that Monday morning afterward, and it was one of those ridiculous 7:30 a.m. finals. So I'm driving to campus at, you know, 6:45 or 7 or something, and I'm driving past the football stadium, and whose silver Cadillac do I pass on Kimball Avenue but Bill Snyder heading into work 2 days after his team's biggest win ever. But like I said, I think that he seems to be energized. He seems to be really taking the challenge head on, and he has one hell of a challenge in front of him with the mess that we have. I don't know how long that'll last. I'd like to think that this is – if it works, is, you know, a 5 to 10 year proposition. I'd like to think that he can get some good assistants in there, like Vic Koning, as the defensive coordinator. And my expectations right now are not real high for this year, but given some of the recruits and players that we're looking at for next year, transfer players included, I think maybe my expectations are starting to come around in the near future.
Yeah, that is a good point about the transfers, because you've got Chris Harper, the Wichita kid who went to Oregon and played, what, quarterback slash running back slash wide receiver for the Ducks at different times last year.
Right.
And there's another one, too. What was his name?
Broderick Smith, who I believe was at Minnesota previously.
Okay. Well, you touched on assistants as well. That was one thing that Snyder always did a very good job of, is he hired good, energetic assistants who recruited well and could, you know, coach obviously very well. Do you see this in this new batch of assistants? Clearly you haven't seen them coach yet or what they can do, but just from their bios and things like that, do you think this is kind of similar to what it was when he first came around to K-State?
My biggest concern is that he has too many of the guys that he had toward the end of his tenure when things fell apart. Very excited about the hire of Vic Koning as defensive coordinator. If you've seen his Clemson defense, if you watch Nebraska play Clemson in the Gator Bowl, which was after he left, you notice Clemson had one hell of a defense last year. They actually knew how to hit, which would be a real improvement in Manhattan right now. I really like Vic Koning. I like Joe Bob Clements as the defensive ends coach because I think he will be a good recruiter in the state of Kansas. He knows the territory. He's kind of a good old boy. You know, Joe Bob, you know, kind of fits in, I guess. I'm not thrilled about Dana Dimmel as the running game coordinator. I'm not thrilled about Del Miller as the passing game coordinator, but given that Bill Snyder's specialty is offense and that he is generally accepted as one of the better offensive minds in college football, I'm going to work with that and see how things go.
It was interesting after a while with that little inside the bubble screen type play that really K-State perfected more than any other school had. It was to the point there in the, you know, late 90s, early part of this decade that everybody else was running that play, but K-State couldn't anymore because that was the one play the other team was going to make sure to try to stop.
Yeah.
That was clearly a very successful play. So on the defense, that was, you know, clearly there was explosive offense for most of those mid-90s teams, but defense was the thing. I mean, it was a dominant defense that kind of made the biggest mark, at least to me. Do you see, just currently on this team, do you see guys on the 2009 roster that you think can really kind of turn a corner with what we are going to assume is much better coaching this year, much more aggressive coaching?
Yeah, I do see some guys that I'm really excited about. Certainly Brandon Harreld, who received some postseason awards last year, despite the fact that we were terrible on a scale unimaginable on defense last year. Brandon Harreld really looks like a beast on the defensive line. He looked good in the spring game from what I hear. Panjandrum was at the spring game, and as I was studying for my legislation final, was texting me updates every 5 or 10 minutes saying, oh, Brandon Harreld looks like a beast. He's got 4 sacks or something. So I like him. There are some other guys on the defensive line that I think will be, with good coaching, I think will be pretty good players. The linebackers are a question. The secondary is a question. We have some good players in the secondary. We have players like Joshua Moore. Joshua Moore in the secondary. And, you know, who knows, maybe with some coaching they will come around. But definitely defensive line, I think we have a chance to really be a lot better than we were the last 2 or 3 years.
Okay. Seth dropped out, by the way. He lost his signal, and I think he just texted me to say he's going to dinner. So, you know, awesome. We imagine this big love fest of, you know, me and Seth and Ross and you and Panjandrum, but it's just us. So we'll keep it going here. I think as a whole, I'm very curious. I don't think K-State these last couple of years, despite Ron Prince's recruiting reputation, he didn't really have a lot to work with, at least on offense. One of my favorite lines from last season was what is a Logan Dold? we really weren't sure exactly what to, I'm not sure exactly what to expect as far as Carson Kaufman goes. Clearly he's a Kaufman, therefore I think he's going to be great.
Right.
We like those Kaufman brothers. We're really hoping we get the next one, although it sounds like K-State's going to have as good a chance as anybody. Yeah. On the offensive side of the ball, you know, Brandon Banks was pretty good, although, I mean, you know, it was hard to tell how good Brandon Banks was because at least against Missouri, you know, he had a couple great plays, but it was when the game had kind of was passed by.
Right.
Think he can kind of take if K-State's in a competitive game, some competitive conference battle, do you see him as a big play guy, like from the first quarter through the end of the fourth quarter? Is he going to be like the number one weapon heading into 09?
I think he probably is. And no offense toward Brandon, who I think is really a really good player. I think that might speak to the fact that we really don't have a lot of playmakers on the offensive side because, you know, a 5'6 guy is your main receiver. I mean, granted, he is really fast and he has great moves and he has really good hands too, but that's a hard target for a quarterback to find in the Big 12. So I'm really excited about him. I noticed Tim Griffin on the ESPN blog rated him as the most underrated player in the Big 12. He clearly has big playability. Last year against Oklahoma, he went for something like a 70-yard touchdown on a short pass over the middle from Freeman. He has big playability, I have no doubt. I don't know if he's, you know, an every quarter, all game long type of threat like that. He's certainly not in the mold of like a Quincy Morgan
right. Or
the other big receivers that we've had over the years. But I think he'll be, especially in a Bill Snyder type offense, because let's face it, a 5'6 receiver in a pro style offense is just not in the mold. That's just doesn't fit the mold. And, not like I would ever suggest that Ron Prince was trying to pound a square peg into a round hole.
No,
not at all. But I think that in more of a spread style offense, more of a college style, college suited offense, and I've heard that we may run a little bit of the Wildcat this year. I think that he can be a great weapon in a Bill Snyder offense.
And I mentioned Logan Dold. I mean, is there a specific running back you think that has emerged maybe in the spring that will probably be the first stringer heading into the fall?
Not really at this point. I think Keith and Valentine made a pretty good impression in the spring. Other than that, I'm not real sure. A lot of the guys on some of the other K-State sites are really high on our talent at running back. I'll be honest, I'm not quite the roster guru that Panjandrum is. But I think Valentine would probably be the guy that I think, with his experience last year and just his, I overall think he's a pretty talented running back. We'll see what happens. Logan Dold is a tough runner. I think maybe he's really undersized to be a fullback, but I don't know. Maybe Snyder has something in store for him, whether it's a fullback, running back, some sort of slot or something. I don't know. We'll see.
It's an interesting time. We have this old MUKU K-State corridor here. It is an interesting time of transition here where you've got Snyder coming back. And, I mean, who knows what the ceiling is, but you do have to figure K-State is going to improve. How much, nobody knows yet. But, they might have a better – if they're showing improvement, they'll have a decent recruiting standing in the Kansas City area, things like that. Meanwhile, Missouri just lost a good cycle of players, and they have to hope that the next one is at least reasonably comparable to the last one. And then next year, Kansas does pretty much the same thing. They're going to lose Reising. They're going to lose Meyer. It wouldn't surprise me if they lost Briscoe, mm-hmm. assuming he doesn't have further discipline problems already.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that Mangino will make sure he does not have further discipline problems.
And they're going to lose Jake Sharp, who isn't amazing, but he's definitely solid. They're going to, and plus they're going to lose Stuckey and Thornton on defense. So it's going to be a time of transition for their talent as well after 2009. If they don't win the North in 2009, their window is going to be pretty interesting, closing pretty fast. So it's going to be just interesting because it's hard to imagine Kansas City producing enough recruits. Not that any of these schools only recruit Kansas City, but it's a major recruiting base for KU, K-State, and Missouri, and Nebraska for that matter.
Yeah,
it's going to be interesting because somebody's going to have to fall. There's going to be a bit of a zero sum game here. Clearly, really Missouri has done very, very well against Mark Mangino head to head for recruits. They get probably six out of every seven that they fight for, but then Mangino goes down to Texas and gets some good players. So, I mean, Texas is big enough that maybe everybody can find kids there. But,
it is, trust me.
I mean, that's right. You're in, Houston right now? Is that?
I actually just moved from Houston to Kansas City. I finished school up about 3 weeks ago, cool. And now I am a Kansas City. I will be getting my Missouri driver's license soon.
Wow. Texas is a big place. And, I still think, though, somebody's going to have to fall. For one person, for one team going up, like Missouri in the early part of this decade, as Gary Pinkel started stockpiling talent from Kansas City and in those surrounding areas, K-State did fall a little bit. So I'm curious to see who goes up and who goes down over the next few years. And really, I'm just curious to see what Bill Snyder can produce. I mean, we were talking beforehand, there isn't a very big sample size of this happening. John Robinson, I think he did it at UNLV and USC as far as leaving a school and then coming back to it. What was the other? Alt from Nevada. He came back after being athletic director for a little while. Bill Walsh did it and really didn't succeed the second time around. And that's really all I can think of. So there's really no good way to get a read on what Snyder's capable of. How old is he?
If I remember correctly, he turned 70 this year.
Well, I mean, if Paterno's setting the bar, then he's got another 15 years to go, I guess.
Well, and he seems to be a pretty, you know, pretty fit, pretty sharp gentleman from what I've seen. I think he takes pretty good care of himself. So, you know, who knows?
So it'll just be, it's going to be an interesting couple of years. Obviously, I hope Blaine Gabbert bounces back, or, you know, allows Missouri to bounce back. They're going to step back this year, but they've been putting together talent. They're going to have, you know, 25 or 30 freshmen and sophomores on the two deep this year. So,
yeah.
I mean, they're kind of building for 2010 and 11. Kansas is going to take a step back. Will Nebraska be able to, you know, every national analyst is just going to keep predicting Nebraska to break through and be a top 15 team again until it happens,
as,
I guess.
As will their fans.
Yeah, and which is always fun. I love it when their fans do it.
Very enjoyable.
But, you know, yeah, national analysts continuing to say Nebraska is Nebraska is, you know, going to get frustrating. But can they break through if Kansas, Kansas State, and Missouri are all putting together good programs still? So, all right, well, clearly we will talk more about K-State football during our little preview podcast here, like another probably 6 or 7 weeks from now. So we're going to move on to one of the bigger topics that have brought Bring on the Cats and Rock'em Nation together, that being bashing on the Big 12 South.
Yes.
Granted, Ross is from Texas, but he doesn't seem to mind bashing on the Big 12 South at any given time. It's pretty easy to do. There a couple of major issues that have come up this off season in football. Well, number one has just been, is it time to redraw the North and South, break them up into two divisions, or just have it one Big 12 team conference where the two top teams, play each other in the Big 12 championship game? I kind of know your thoughts on that, but go ahead and share your thoughts on that.
Well, yeah, I don't think we've reached the point where it's time to do something drastic with the Big 12. I realize, and I fully admit, the Big 12 South is absolutely kicking the North's ass up and down the field right now. I would be like a Holocaust denier to deny that. Sorry, I don't mean to get political or anything. There's no doubt the South is light years ahead of the North right now. But if you take a second and step back and look at when the conference began, the South was quite a long ways behind the North when the conference began. Nebraska had just produced what a lot of observers consider the greatest team in the history of college football in 1995,
yeah,
the year before the Big 12 began. Colorado won maybe one of the most controversial national titles, split national titles, in 91, I believe. And K-State was an up-and-coming team that was starting to win 10 or 11 games a year. KU had a good year in 95 or something.
I think so. I think 95.
Yeah. And really, the Southwest Conference was a disaster at the end of its time. And yeah, Texas had some good years, but they had some pretty bad years. Texas A&M was pretty good when the conference began, but as we've seen, they really haven't sustained that at all. Texas Tech was nothing when this, I mean, they, you know, Spike Dykes was a solid coach and a gentleman from what I'm told, but you know, he was good for 6-5 or 7-4, never threatening on the national stage at all. And, you know, Baylor's Baylor, not going to even really worry about them. But, you know, I realized that this was an old Big Eight, but Oklahoma was a disaster when the Big 12 began. They were terrible.
Yeah, that was right around, I think 95 was the Schnellenberger year.
Yeah.
Which living in Oklahoma at that time was very satisfying. just the best thing in the world, I don't remember the score of this game, but I just remember Colorado's starting quarterback was questionable for the OU-Colorado game. I think it was one of the Detmers, maybe Coy. And Schnellenberger just all week in the press, and which I got to see on a day-to-day basis, was to say, well, I hope he's healthy. I don't want them to have any excuses when we kick their ass. And Colorado literally won like 42-11 or something like that.
Yeah.
I think Detmer didn't play.
Well, I grew up in Nebraska, as I don't know if some people have seen that, some people haven't. I grew up in Nebraska, and I remember, I think it was in 97 or something, I distinctly remember being in Memorial Stadium when Nebraska beat Oklahoma something like 62-something. I don't even remember what it was. Which was really a shock for me, because I had also been there in about 1993 when they played a game in, I don't know, the temperature couldn't have been more than about 25, and it snowed the night before, and Nebraska won like 13-10 or something. It was just a classic of an old Big Eight slug it out battle. So to see Oklahoma fall off that much was really a shock. But, you know, getting back to you know, to the whole Big 12 North, Big 12 South thing. True, the North never was as far ahead of the South as the South is ahead of the North right now. But there were certainly some times when... hello.
Sorry, my phone... it's an 800 number, but my phone talks to me, so you're going to have to... It's the creepiest thing ever.
That's all right. I've learned to talk over things.
So okay, you're good. You're good. My wife answered.
Knocked off a bit then. certainly the South is farther ahead of the North now than the North ever was ahead of the South. But there were years when the second place team in the North could make a legitimate claim to being the second best team in the conference. So forgive me, Longhorn fans, for really not feeling all that sorry for you this past season. I agree. But I agree that you, quote-unquote, got screwed. But, as I've said, this was a three-way tie, and this was the fifth tiebreaker that we had to get down to break it. You can't there wasn't a good system for doing that. We're choosing between a bad system, a worse system, and the worst system at that point.
Yeah, I think I actually enjoyed Mike Leach's solution the best, and clearly he only did this because it would serve Tech. But if we're, right. if we're serious about... getting academics involved, make that fifth tiebreaker the APR scores.
Right.
I
right.
love that idea.
I don't like that idea because I don't think it will ever favor my program. But you know, not to say that Bill Snyder doesn't graduate his players. Actually, I think he does a decent job of that. But, you know, looking at the APR scores, we're not going to be leading the conference anytime soon. And I don't really like the APR all that well. But that's
No. I like the intent, but it has a long way to go.
What do you do when you get to a fifth tiebreaker for a three-way divisional tie? I mean, I don't think there is a good way to do that. I mean, I've suggested some systems, and a couple of Texas readers on my site, as I've written before, have suggested some systems that might be better than what we have, and I actually think that those would be worth looking into, and I'm really disappointed that Texas just chose to say, well, this is how the SEC does it. Right. You should do it this way. I'm tired of the thinking that we can't look beyond what other conferences do to find a better way to do something.
And with Texas, the only reason they were suggesting it is because it favored them. I mean, right. We hate that, as you pointed out before, it's, you know, we hate that BCS standings are being used for this. So let's use it twice. Let's use it to eliminate the third team. And then we'll go head-to-head because that way Texas would have won. I mean, that was their whole justification for using that one was, here's a way that we could break the tie where Texas wins. I think, honestly, the best solution I've seen anywhere was in Oklahoma high school football. And, you know, we talk about point differential. It's really hard to tie when you do point differential. The problem with point differential is running up the score.
Right.
Well, I don't remember what the cap is, but basically there's a ceiling on how much credit you can get for any one game. If you beat a team, it's like 21 points or 24. So basically, if you beat them 24-0, you're a plus 24 for that game. If you beat them 100-0, you're a plus 24. So
okay.
And so, I mean, you could see a situation where a team's up, you know, 23 points, and they leave their first stringers in to kick a worthless field goal at the end. But, you know, that would be very annoying. But on the list of annoyances, that's pretty far down the list.
I agree. And over the years on my site, I've espoused my thoughts on running up the score. And unless you're playing a non-conference game, unless you're playing a K-State-style non-conference game against middle directional Tech, State, U, whatever.
Chronic Fatigue University, that was it.
Chronic Fatigue University, thank you. Yes, a very good opponent. Unless you're playing a game like that against a completely overmatched team that you really shouldn't be playing to begin with, maybe once a year. I don't have a problem with running up the score. If you're in the Big 12 Conference, you should be considered a team that is legitimately capable of holding your own. And I don't necessarily encourage those tactics, but I don't feel bad. Like, and I will never complain on my site that some other team ran the score up on us, because I'm going to look at our defense and say, look, we need to stop that. We need to get better so that we can stop the other team. If you're playing a Big 12 team, I'm not going to, you know, I'm never going to say, well, you ran up the score. That's really poor sportsmanship. Yeah. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but I don't know. I don't get too worked up about that.
Yeah, I really, it's a very slippery slope, or maybe not a slippery slope, but it's a very dicey area. There's a lot of gray area with running up the score. Because I remember last year, Nevada, Missouri, it was close for a little while. Missouri turned it on, was beating them by, I don't know, 40. Wolfer came on for a really long field goal attempt, and they ran a fake just to kind of move the chains. And, well, Pinkel said to move the chains and, just not give the ball back and continue to work the clock a little bit. Now, he didn't, the way he told it, he didn't plan on Chase Coughlin stiff-arming about 17 guys and getting, like, a 45-yard gain out of the play. But... it's so circumstantial whether somebody actually decided I'm going to run up the score or whether they threw a little short pass to get the backup some work and the wide receiver broke it for a 75-yard touchdown. But I mean, at the same time, one of my favorite things is, watching the blowout and watching the first string come off the field, and knowing that that was their last play. I enjoy that. I enjoy not having to, because we grew to hate Ron Prince so much, at the end of the last year's game, it's 41-10 or 42-10, whatever it is, and Missouri's second string comes in, and Brandon Banks scores, breaks two long runs, and K-State scores 14 points on the second stringers. I mean, it's kind of, if that was Missouri coming, and we've had plenty of experience in getting blown out, I never really minded it then. It annoyed the crap out of me when we were the team who was saying, okay, game's over, second stringer's in, and, some first stringer scored a touchdown on us, like Nebraska scored on the very last play of the game. Against our second string, but in the end, it just doesn't really matter. I mean, you can get annoyed by it one way or the other because you're rooting for a specific team involved, but I guess, in the end, it just doesn't matter.
I agree. I think it should probably just be a gentleman's agreement between the coaches. If the leading team takes its starters out, the opponent should say, okay, they're backing off on us. Let's get our, we might as well get our backups some experience now. So.
Yeah. So
I want to say that I actually I had not heard you mention that tiebreaker that is used in Oklahoma high school football. But from what I hear, I like that idea.
I don't know where the cap would be set because it'd be a media thing. They'd start fretting about running the score up. They love talking about teams running the score up. And so I don't know where you would set the cap to where it would be sportsmanlike or whatever. 21's probably too low. 35's too high. Somewhere 24, 28. And I mean, really, in that sense, that seems to be, well, it works in Oklahoma. I mean, there's such a big talent disparity. I mean, teams are winning games 73-0 all the time in high school football, but it seems to do the trick. So, I mean, that would be my one toss into, the one thing I throw into the ring there because, in the end, without points, there is no good fifth tiebreaker. And Texas fans were screwed, or were angry because they were screwed, because they got screwed by the situation. They chose the wrong year to have a really good team. The Mac Brown being on every, I think he was on Bloomberg that week before the Big 12 championship or before Thanksgiving or whatever it was. And it was just so disingenuous that they let him go on there and rail against this unfair system when the solution he was proposing was equally fair or unfair. There was nothing any better about it. And as we've said, it was probably worse because it used the BCS rankings, but it didn't even use it in a final way. Just used it to eliminate the one team that happened to beat Texas. And then, they could go head to head 45-35 and all that.
See, and that's really what irritated me about the whole situation. And I might have given Mac Brown the benefit of the doubt if not for the few years ago when he lobbied so hard to get past Cal into the Rose Bowl. I might have said, okay, I understand his team's really good. He thinks they deserve it. They beat Oklahoma head to head, blah, blah, blah. But the propensity thing with him drove me nuts. And that whole thing leads me, the thing that you mentioned with going on Bloomberg and whatever else he did, that's why I really like SB Nation and the blogosphere, because we have people that looked at it and analyzed the situation and put their thoughts down and looked at it from both sides. Mac Brown went on ESPN and Bloomberg and whatever and said, well, gosh, golly, our guys have worked so hard this year and I just don't think it's fair that this happens. They go, oh, that's too bad, Mac. I really think you're right. Instead of saying, well, Mac, what do you think about the fact that Texas Tech is tied with you too? Are they getting screwed over in this? So
yeah,
that's my thought on it.
Yeah, no, and you're absolutely right. And Before we move on to the very last Big 12 topic, I was going to go back to the whole North versus South thing for a second and just say that you're only as good as your next coaching hire. Every single team that's good, that's really good right now. Pete Carroll was hired because, what was his name? Paul Hackett was terrible. Meyer was hired because Ron Zook was terrible. Bob Stoops was hired because John Blake was really terrible. Mac Brown was hired because John Makovic didn't work out. I mean, right. Every single team, you're only as good as your next hire. All these teams that are great right now have been mediocre in the last 15 years because of the head coach. And so, you know, if Bob Stoops does, say, someday take on an NFL job, or if Mac Brown retires and it turns out that Muschamp, like some fiery defensive coordinators, isn't a very good head coach. You know, it does happen. And, you know, it's that simple. As soon as the head coach leaves, the next one might be just as great and he might be terrible. And there's really no way to predict it ahead of time.
No, there really isn't. And even in a lot of cases, past performance at whatever level doesn't necessarily show that your hire is going to be good. And yeah, Texas and Oklahoma have the inherent advantage that they can throw ungodly sums of money.
Right.
At a football coach, so generally they should be able to get the best. But I interviewed Tim Weiser a few years ago when I was still at K-State, when he was the athletic director there. He said, a school like K-State has to be smarter than a school like Texas. We have to be really careful with who we hire. Obviously didn't happen with hiring Ron Prince, but we have to be smarter than a school like Texas, because Texas hires the wrong guy. Yeah, it's going to hurt them for however long they give him, and maybe a year or two after that. And then if they don't hire the right guy, then it's going to continue on. But, you know, they can throw money at a problem like that. K-State's going to be, if we end up having to pay all this money, we're going to be out $7 million, which is something like a little less than a fifth of our operating budget for a year. Huh. I mean, that's going to be a pretty solid shot to the gut for our bottom line.
Yeah, I think coaches matter so much. And you know, as I've been doing these Mizzou history posts on Rock M, it is funny because, I mean, they went from Don Faro to Frank Broyles, which, I mean, it didn't work out. He left after a year, but still, that was, you know, they hired a very good coach,
right.
But he ended up going to Arkansas. So they hired Dan Devine, who succeeded for 15 years at Missouri, was their most consistently good coach. He basically handpicked Al Onofrio, who, you know, was equally good against ranked teams and terrible teams, and so that didn't really work out. You know, they replaced Onofrio, they interviewed LaVell Edwards and Pat Dye, and they picked Warren Powers.
Yeah.
Powers doesn't work out, so they interview John Cooper, and they speak to Bobby Ross, I think. No. The former Georgia Tech, he went on to Georgia Tech, I'm blanking on his name. Maybe it was Bobby Ross. Anyway. And then they hired Woody Woodenhofer. I mean, there's, you know, at that time, you never know who's going to be a good hire and who isn't. But, you know, it just takes one. And at the very least, the really rich programs will still take a step back for a while, you know, like Florida did. They were still good. They were still 8-5, but that's not Florida good. And so
right.
They hire Urban Meyer. They go right back to winning national titles and 12 wins a game. So that's all it takes. If OU hires the next coach, doesn't work out, suddenly the South isn't stronger than the North anymore. Suddenly there's Texas and some good teams, but by that point, you know, Missouri or Nebraska or Kansas State or Colorado even, any of those teams could be just as good. And
right.
There's more money in the South, so therefore it's like in baseball that, you know, the more money you have, the more margin for error you have, but it could very, very well, at least to some extent, balance out again in the near future. Well, not near future. In the next 5 to 10 years, we'll say.
At some point, it will come around. And
correct.
that's another good reason why I oppose radically realigning the Big 12 right now. Because all these Texas fans right now are talking about, oh, the winner of the Red River Shootout is always going to be, or Oklahoma and Texas are always going to be the two best teams in the South. Well, no, they're not necessarily.
Yeah, Texas A&M was the first 5 or 6 years of the conference.
Yeah, A&M was noticeably better, I think, than Texas. You know, I haven't looked at the win-loss record the first, you know, 5 years of the Big 12, but overall, they were a better team and a better program the first 5 years or so of the Big 12. And like you said, one bad coach is all it takes. Oklahoma knows that. Texas, everybody has such short memories right now because all they remember is 2005 and all this and that. But they forget John Makovic, and they forget 4-8, and they forget K-State beating them 54-7 or whatever. I mean, it doesn't necessarily take much for a team like Texas or any program, really, to end up not nearly as good as they want to be.
Yeah, plus geographic rivalries matter. I mean, I would much rather play Kansas and Kansas State and Nebraska on a yearly basis than Texas Tech and or Baylor or, you know, just teams that we're 12 hours away from. Can't really, right. You know, students really can't travel to the games. And it's just so much better when you're playing, you know, geographic rivals. And I think that's one of the reasons, you know, all this Big Ten expansion talk comes around every single year. Missouri's always mentioned, so is Pittsburgh and Rutgers and whoever else. There's a 1% chance that it ever happens and Missouri's involved. But really, thinking about it from that standpoint, geographically, it would be kind of fun to, you know, have a 6-hour trip to Wisconsin, a 7-hour trip to Minnesota, a 6-hour trip to Indiana, you know, instead of having half your conference be 12 hours away.
Sure.
But, I mean, really, yeah, it's not going to happen. We're happy where we are. At this point, I've written lots of posts about it over the years, and at this point, I just don't really have enough energy to, because I don't care. Like, I like it where we are. If Missouri ever decides to move, then you know what? It'll take me about 3 months, and I'll get over it, and I'll enjoy that, too, because it's just sports, you know?
Yeah, it is. And on that subject, as we close up here, we're talking about the radical realignment.
Yeah.
On top of what you mentioned, on top of not wanting to have divisional opponents like Texas Tech, which is an ungodly amount of they're an ungodly amount of time away from DFW. That's Godspeed to Seth down at Double T Nation, but that is a really long, really crappy drive.
Yeah.
But just putting different teams in a division is not going to raise the level of play of the other teams. It just means that, you know, maybe it's beneficial to Oklahoma and Texas, if they're the two best teams, not having to, you know, be pitted against each other for the right to play some 9-3 team from the north. But that's not going to improve the conference as a whole. That's not going to bring up the level of play from a K-State or a Colorado or whatever. That's just not going to happen with realignment. So,
well, I know you did a little research. Speaking of what might improve the level of play with everybody, I know you've done a little research on revenue sharing.
Yes.
That is another thing that, you know, separates the Big 12 from a conference like the Big 10 and otherwise. And, you know, the Big 10 splits things pretty much evenly, I think. Television revenues, things like that. And granted, you know, we can debate whether that's helped the conference or not.
Right.
But it is an interesting time to be a fan of a Big 12 school not located in Texas.
Yeah.
Where a good portion of the money is. So, yeah, I'll cede the floor to you here to wrap up, talk a little bit about revenue sharing.
Okay, well, I looked at the numbers because the numbers came out the other day of how much each Big 12 team received from the conference. I calculated that if each team – if we shared all revenue equally like the Big Ten does, and I may be wrong, but I think perhaps the SEC does equal revenue sharing. I could be wrong about that.
I'm not sure.
If we shared all revenue equally, each team, each program, each school would have received $8.58 million from the conference. There were five teams that were above that number. And the way it works out is there would be two teams that would – lose more than $1 million, and there would be two teams that would gain more than $1 million. Obviously, the two teams that would lose would be Texas and Oklahoma. The two teams that would gain more than $1 million would be Iowa State and Baylor down at the bottom. Everybody else falls into kind of a muddy middle where they gain anywhere from $600,000 to gaining $500,000. So, you know, we can make an argument, you know, we can argue about whether $500,000 really makes a huge difference in an athletic department. But I think for schools that are kind of, you know, kind of toward the bottom of revenue sharing, I think that, you know, anything more than we're talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Right.
Obviously, I'd be thrilled to be handed, you know, $500,000. But, you know, in the world of college athletics, maybe it's not.
Well, I just think,
deal.
As far as Iowa State goes, though, I mean, you know, $500,000 wouldn't allow them to compete in football. But, you know, they just lost in wrestling. They just lost Cale Sanderson, you know, the Iowa State grad, who, like, all of his brothers have gone to Iowa State. They just lost him as head coach to Penn State. And you have to figure maybe if they had a little extra money, because, I mean, that's kind of their pride and joy is their wrestling program right now.
That's maybe really not, all they have right now.
Right, maybe not by intention, but, right. I mean, that's just the way it is. And they just lost their, you know, their not hometown guy, but, I mean, he's an Iowa State grad, and he just left his alma mater for Penn State. And, you know, at the very least, they could have maybe kept Sanderson with that money. So
yeah, and Iowa State would have stood to gain through equal revenue sharing. They would have stood to gain $1.18 million this year. For a school that I'm guessing, I don't have the figures in front of me, I'm guessing their athletic department budget for the year is probably something like $35
million. Yeah, surely, probably, yeah.
That's a pretty significant gain. And like you said, with a coach like Sanderson, they've got an extra 1.1 laying around. They could surely throw an extra, you know, whoever knows how much.
Yeah, I don't know how much wrestling salaries are, but you think they could have probably thrown enough at him to keep him.
They could have definitely sweetened the pot for him and kept, you know, for sure kept their top flight wrestling program on the level that it's been. And for schools that fall below the cutoff line, the average line, that's probably what that's going to be put to, because an extra couple $100,000 isn't going to make that much of a dent in facilities.
Right.
But if you spread it around to your coaches, to your more important coaches, you know, K-State can throw a few extra $100,000 to Frank Martin. and maybe give Brad Hill, the baseball coach, an extension and a raise, things of that nature. I realize, and I've had this argument with fans of mostly Texas on my site, I realize that the gains are not humongous. We're not talking about schools gaining $2-4 million. But this, by the same token, we're talking about Texas losing $1.6 million, which, granted, 1.6 is in an absolute sense a lot of money,
but not for Texas.
Texas with a $100 million athletic department budget, yeah, which for all intents and purposes is really unlimited. Practically unlimited.
Yeah.
That's really not that huge of a deal. I mean, what are they going to have one less Godzillatron at their stadium, or, you know, one less expansion to 110,000 fans or whatever that they're probably going to end up at soon? I don't know.
Yeah. And I mean, the other thing about it, you know, keeping coaches really could make a difference, even if it doesn't improve facilities. Cause I mean, as I've been reading these things for the Mizzou history pieces, I mean, back to back, Iowa State in the '70s had Johnny Majors and Earl Bruce, and didn't keep either one of them. Like, couldn't keep Majors from going to Pittsburgh, couldn't keep Bruce from going to Ohio State. And maybe that would have happened anyway, especially with Bruce, I think. But, right. I mean, just having a little more money to work with and showing that you're a viable program can't hurt. And it would help the lower revenue schools more than it would hurt the higher revenue schools. So I just don't really see why it wouldn't happen.
I agree. And, you know, to throw the political argument or analogy out there, the rising tide, right, you know, raises all ships, right, or whatever. Maybe I have that not quite correct.
It's close enough. I know what you're saying.
I think I got the point across, but
well, trickle down economics certainly does not work in college football.
No, it certainly does not. And really, from the beginning, maybe I'm making too broad of a statement here, but really from the beginning, I don't think Texas has ever been about improving the conference. They've been about improving Texas, which, you know, self-interest has to play a part.
Right.
You know, you have to be interested in improving your own product, or you're not, you know, you're not going to improve. I'm not saying that K-State's not interested in improving their own product. But at some point, if the Big 12 becomes Texas and Oklahoma and 10 other schools that, you know, are nothing more than, well, and then maybe two or three other schools that are sort of competitive nationally and sort of not, and then everybody else is basically on like a Conference USA level or something, that's not going to help Texas in the long run. And, you know, their fans always talk about, oh, let's go to the Big Ten or the ACC or the Pac-10, yeah, or whatever. Well, first of all, they didn't want you 15 years ago. So I don't really know that you're going to just be able to snap your fingers and do that. And second of all, at some point, if the competitiveness really falls off, it's going to hurt you in a national title race, because they're going to look at your conference schedule and say, oh, yeah, well, you beat up on, I'll just say K-State, just to, you know, be self-effacing. But, you know, you beat up on teams like K-State in your conference, you know, whoop-de-doo. You know, and given the non-conference schedules Texas has been playing this year in the last few years,
yeah,
there's not a lot of heft there. And if this keeps going the way it is, I think it's going to start hurting them. And it'll be interesting to see if that brings them around. Honestly, I think our best chance at equal revenue sharing is continual suckage for Texas A&M. So.
Well, I'm all for that, really. You know, in the end. All right. Well, we have, you know, with just a two-person podcast, we've managed to cross the 50-minute barrier.
Wow.
So, but you know, it's been fun. Next time we'll have you know, a lot more humor involved when Jan Drum and Ross and Seth are more involved. But this was a nice little wonky podcast, which I always enjoy. All right. Well,
I apologize for my verbosity in getting us beyond the 50-minute barrier.
I
had no idea we'd reached that level.
I really don't think, as soon as we pass 20 minutes, I really don't think it matters anymore. I don't know how many people actually listen to this. My joke is that about two people do, you know, and I'm sure those two people are still listening. So,
well, good.
Yeah.
Hello to Mizzou fans.
All right. Well, this has been fun. We will catch up again later in the summer when we have the whole crew together. But yeah, we wanted to get the Unholy Alliance together a little bit, especially since really in the end, Missouri and K-State are pretty similar athletic programs, and we both hate Kansas, which is fun.
Hey, the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Exactly.
When
K-State fans did the beat KU chant after Missouri beat K-State 2 years ago, that was my opinion of K-State went improved by infinity. So.
Do you think that was the solidifying moment of the Unholy Alliance?
Yeah, we hadn't even chatted that much by that point, but yeah, that opened the door.
I think it did. I wish I would have been in the stands that day so that I could say that I was a part of that. But
yeah, that was fun stuff. So screw Kansas, and we'll talk to you in however long it is, another month or two. And until next time, this has been the fastest 52 minutes in podcasting. We're going to leave a little exit music because I am a Dave Matthews nerd, and a new Dave Matthews album came out 2 days ago. We are going to leave with my favorite track thus far from the new album. This is called Why I Am, and we'll talk to you guys next week. Thanks again, Ty.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
All right.